Good morning, worthy historians. I'm Jay Sammons here with my longtime friend and Boston University colleague, Professor Brendan McConville.
Coming to you from the shadow of Bellevue Hill and the mystical banks of the electronic Charles.
Yes, and spring is definitely here, and I can tell that because of your t-shirt, Professor McConville.
Yes, have you ever seen me in a t-shirt before?
Thank God, no.
No, right, right. My attire is entirely summery. My office here in Bellevue Hill is very warm. It's the warmest room in my home.
Uh-oh.
And yeah, I would say it's 90 degrees in this room right now.
Oh, goodness gracious.
Yeah, between 85 and 90. It's extremely warm in here.
Wow. So do you have Bermuda shorts on too, like a classic middle-aged American male?
No, I don't, but I won't reveal what I do have on that
okay,
way.
Okay, thank goodness.
I'll leave it to your imagination, yes. Right.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I'm well. I welcome the spring. I welcome the warmness in the spring. In fact, I think I'll make myself a celebratory breakfast for spring this morning. How does that sound?
Absolutely fantastic.
Well, let me tell you what I'm going to have, and you can tell me if you think, I don't think it's going to sound fantastic to you then. I'm going to make myself a bacon and cheese omelet with some fresh asparagus to go along with it. Also, two or three links of sausage.
That's it. Look, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. And maybe I'll even put a piece of fruit on the side there.
See, that sounds entirely good and healthy to me. It's just not my thing because eggs are involved.
Right.
But and eggs and asparagus are involved.
Oh, you don't like asparagus? Well, they're not white, so you wouldn't eat
them. Yeah, not particularly, no. You know, my whole vegetable experience, as I've said before on the show many episodes ago, was shaped by my father's tendency to try to force me to eat frozen bird's eye vegetables, which were overcooked in the best traditions of Ireland. And it has turned me off to vegetables for my entire life.
Well, I'm not going to try to win you back to them.
No.
Well, what are you going to have for breakfast then? No vegetables. We know that.
No, I'm staying on the keto, low carb. Yeah. I'm having a small bowl of bran, three strips of bacon, some red grapes, and a little Havarti cheese on the side.
I see. Good. Well, you notice I'm not having the bread this morning because I don't want to taunt you with it. Right.
Once again, after all these years, it just shows how considerate you are about my feelings. Right. Right.
We've always known that. It's a quality we share.
It's a quality we share. Right.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's getting to be commencement time in the world of college professors.
Yes, it is.
It's a little different this year without any official, outdoor events. I think BU had only virtual graduation.
No, BU had some people in people. Some
oh, did they?
In
good.
Person. Yes,
good.
They did have some people in person. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Our department didn't. I know. Did the history department?
No, that was virtual. But yeah. I mean, the other events were held in person, and of course, we're coming out now. I incidentally have now reached, the 2 weeks after the second shot, and I'm walking around outside without a mask, and I bring a mask with me. The only time I would deploy it is going into a small enclosed store or space. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I'm headed towards mask free. I'm still wearing my mask at the grocery store, but that's because the law, the change doesn't mm-hmm. go into effect until May 29th when it comes. I'll demask, as long as people think it's still safe.
I have some new data on this subject that I'm going to share with you offline. But I will also say that now that everyone is taking their masks off, I've decided to start wearing mine.
Well, they are a threat to you.
I'm going to go full mask all the time now. I can't be a part of this movement somehow.
Right.
I want to go.
Yes. You're contrarian nature.
I'm a contrarian.
So am I. So,
Well, I offered you a chance to do something else this week, but you said no. Let's continue on with the pre-classical archaic Greece arc. So that's what we're going to do, unless you spring something on me now and say, no, I was kidding.
No, I'm in the process of putting my book on North Carolina to bed. I'm doing the final edits, and so I'm focused on that since we once talked about it long ago. There's no sense in going on about that. And so it's just right now I'm just trying to get through, which I found very difficult at the end of the term to do that kind of close reading and rereading of the manuscript to
Are
get
these
the
final
out.
Page proofs?
The uncorrected page proofs, yeah. And so I actually have...
Will you get a second look at the page proofs, or are you just getting this one?
Just this one. I'm actually making more changes than I have in the past.
Oh, boy.
But Well, but it nothing that ruptures the page or paragraph structures or anything like that. It's just words.
Makes me nervous to change things when they're in page proofs.
I agree, but there's just a few things that needed to be, you know, it's been hard because of the way the epidemic went and everything. I think it's been hard to work on this stuff and keep working, particularly as strange as it sounds, you know, keep working at it.
I don't know if I ever told you this story or not, but the very last page of my first book, Empire of the Owl, when I had the proofs, I decided that I wanted to rewrite the last paragraph.
Well, I wouldn't do that.
I know. And I put about four or five new lines, took a bunch of lines out and rewrote the last, you know, two or three sentences.
Right.
And looking back on it now, I can't believe how stupid that was. You know, talk about trusting people that, you know, it worked out fine. They actually made a bunch of other mistakes in the book, but they didn't mess up the last paragraph. But I would never take that kind of chance today.
One thing I would say is that publishing has changed since I've finished my last book. And it's, you know, it's just academic publishing is under a lot of pressure, quite frankly. And as we've talked about in the past, and it's no, you know, it's not against the press I'm working with or anything like that, but it's just the system has changed somewhat, you know, and it's not, you know.
They rely on the author to do everything now. The author does everything.
Their copy editor was fine. It was, you know,
it's a miracle you had one.
Right.
That's what I would say.
Right. No, their copy editor was fine. And these page proofs were fine. The things that I want to change in there are generally one word type of thing, substituting one word for another. But there was one spot, which was my fault, where I inverted two sentences in a paragraph, which don't, in other words, I want to keep the two sentences, but change them back to their correct order because I did that. I screwed up, you know, I mean, it would be, it doesn't make as much sense as it's now structured.
Right.
So,
right. Well, I'm glad you're having a fairly good experience with your proofs and are almost done with it. You'll feel very relieved when that's over. I know.
Yes, I will.
And having read that book twice already, I suppose I will be spared having to read it a third time.
I joke about that in the acknowledgments audience.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing it. So we're going to talk about the period called the Dark Age in Greek history. So we're talking about the period from about 1100 or 1150 BC to about 800 BC. And not to be confused with the Dark Ages, you know, we saw that the world of the incredibly cosmopolitan world of the Eastern Mediterranean collapse, almost completely collapse in the last episode around 1200 BC. And we're going into a period now of basically 300 to 400 years of no literacy in the Greek world. And that's one of the things, one of the main reasons it's called dark.
Can I tell you, do you think any literacy survived in there?
I'm going to talk about it. Yes.
Okay.
Some did. We know that some did. And, you know, but it's sometimes I hear people talk about, they call the medieval world, the early medieval world, the Dark Age, or they call this period the Dark Ages. But no, medieval Europe has the Dark Ages, plural.
Right.
And Greece has the Dark Age, singular. And, you know, it started off pretty damn dark if we think about last episode with all these sea peoples marauding across the Eastern Mediterranean, apparently destroying their own cultures oftentimes because all these Greek palaces seem to have been, most of them were either abandoned and a lot of them were sacked.
These people must have known they were destroying the world, right? I mean, at some point somebody must have said, hey, there's no one left to loot, you know? Yeah,
good,
I mean,
it's a good thing we don't deal with that in the 21st century, people who know they're destroying their own culture.
Right, good point.
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? Human beings, apparently. And as we talked about last time, we apparently have these kind of multi-ethnic coalitions of pirates, essentially. And, you know, this world is reflected quite clearly in Homer's poetry. I mean, the Iliad and the Odyssey, if you tear away a lot of the superstructure, are really stories about people who raid other cultures.
Right.
I mean, even the Homeric heroes who are encamped at Troy, how does this argument start out in Homer over this girl, Briseis? Okay. Well, she was a prize that Achilles had taken from one of his raids on other cities. So the whole context, even though they're trying to sack Troy, they're raiding all these other cities. Odysseus in the Odyssey, when he stabs the Cyclops, right, and puts his eye out, and he's leaving, and he tells the Cyclops, "Hey, you tell your friends that the person who took your eye out was Odysseus, the son of Laertes of Ithaca, the sacker of cities."
Right.
Right. He proudly tells the guy, "That's what I do." So it's not as if this world is covered up in Homer's account of it. But so we've got this culture that's breaking down, but we also have at the same time, and paradoxically, the emergence of a new technology that's going to revolutionize the world, and it's still doing so, and that's iron. We're going to enter the Iron Age around 1100, whereas before, all the weapons and defensive
bronze
has been made of bronze.
Right.
Now around 1100, on the top of some windy mountain in Asia Minor, apparently, somebody got his furnace up hot enough that he could actually smelt iron ore. And
Do we know how he achieved that? By confining
is that they did use windy mountaintops because they didn't have the bellows technology to make the in fact, that's why some of the gods that are associated with fire and with manufacturing are associated with mountains. Okay. So iron shows up, the world is collapsing, and yet there's a new technology, and weapons after about 1100 are going to be made with iron. They're going to be the same weapons, okay? The same kind of swords, that now a type 2 sword we talked about, it's going to be made with iron instead of bronze. Same thing with helmets, et cetera, et cetera. Although the Greeks tended to use bronze for helmets well into the classical period. Another interesting thing that's going on in this period is movements of mass populations, Greek populations. It looks like that there were two waves of movements around Greece in the period, let's say, between about 1100 and 900. First, the Greeks who were living in the Balkan Peninsula during the Mycenaean period, many of them left, okay, and fled. One place they went was Cyprus, okay, which is way over in the eastern Mediterranean. You know, Cyprus is closer to Israel than it is to anything Greek.
To Athens, right. Closer to Israel than it is to Athens.
Far closer.
Right.
And we know that some Greeks moved across the Aegean from the mainland into the islands and into Asia Minor, as we talked about last time. And the first Greeks to do that become the Greeks of Asia Minor who speak the dialects that are called Aeolian and Ionian dialects, okay? Now, whether these are really ethnic tribal divisions, you know, they're linguistic divisions, okay? They're people who speak different dialects of Greek, but the Greeks themselves thought of them as significant. They thought Ionian Greeks had a particular kind of personality, right? Okay.
Right. And the only mainland city that remained Ionian is Athens, correct?
Well, no, that's not quite the case, because many of the cities of Euboea or Evia, that long island that runs along the eastern coast of central Greece, were Ionian cities like Colchis and Eretria and places like that.
But on the mainland.
Well, that's true. That's an island. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. There weren't very many Ionian Greeks. I guess you're right. But the Athenians had a tradition of, you know, never having left their home and of surviving this period of disruption when other Greeks were passing through Athens. So this plays into the Athenians' view of themselves. So maybe we'll come back and talk a little bit more about that.
We're coming up on our first break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Hi, this is Mike DeStacio, host of Real Talk with the Hollywood Kid. Join me every Saturday from 2 to 3 when I'll be interviewing some of the biggest stars in showbiz right here on the legendary airwaves of AM 1550. And you can also stream us worldwide at WNTN1550AM.com. You can climb a mountain. You can swim the sea.
This is Mike Janity. Join me every Thursday afternoon between 12 noon and 2 o'clock for our Cape Cod Happy Hour Party, featuring all of your favorite party and sing-along songs from the 60s, 70s, and 80s right here on WNTN 1550 AM and WNTN.com.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking about the dark age of Greece. Literacy is lost. The palaces are abandoned or destroyed. Mass numbers of Greeks are fleeing to the islands where they will live happy lives, eating almonds, drinking wine, eating cheese pies. Didopitas. But you know, the other thing that the other mass movement that goes on in this period, Professor McConville, is of course what scholars used to call the Dorian invasion, because a new kind of Greek shows up in these years. And
where do they show up from?
Well, the north, okay? Probably the area around what's today what was in antiquity Macedonia, today's northern Greece. And their own tradition said they came from the north. The term Dorian probably comes from an area of north central Greece called Doris, which is near Delphi. It's not quite as far north as they probably came from, but at least they had these traditions that they came from the north. Now, scholars used to think that a lot of the things that changed in the Dark Age happened because the Dorians came in and sort of pushed everything over. And even the ancient Greeks thought that the Dorian invasion had followed about two generations after the Trojan War. Okay, so they didn't associate these two events, but they did think those Dorians showed up pretty soon after the Trojan War when all this bad stuff was going on. The term invasion has been canceled, as you know.
Right.
You can't use the word for almost anything anymore.
They came and explored their feelings with the local population.
Right, exactly, right. So there are two reasons for that. One, now a lot of scholars think, well, they didn't come in force and violently. And so we shouldn't call it an invasion. Frankly, I think that the idea that there was no violence involved is ludicrous. I think there almost certainly was violence involved. There always is. You know?
Yeah, I don't see how any rational person could reach that conclusion.
As a historian, if you have to answer any question, violence or no violence, the default answer should be violence. Yeah.
Now, of course, the most famous of the Dorian-speaking people that I know about are the Spartans, right?
They're far and away. Dorians par excellence.
Right. Yeah. Now, the people they subjugated, the Helots, were they there before them? Were they there before this Dark Age?
Right, right. Well, this is a very intriguing question that we can't answer definitively. But I would say the best guess is that the Helots were the pre-Dorian Greek population. So they're the Greeks who didn't get out of Dodge and make it to the islands or over to Asia Minor when these Dorian guys show up and tell them, guess what? You guys are not part of our deal, right? You're not Dorians, so you're going to work for us. And the word Helot means something like taken, the people who are taken, okay? And they're enserfed, okay? They weren't enslaved. They weren't turned into chattel slaves. They were attached to the land. They weren't owned by individual Spartans. They were owned by the state, if you think of them as being owned, but they're really more like serfs. They're attached to the land. And but in other places in the Peloponnese in southern Greece, these Dorians show up and they're not quite able to helotize the population. And in some cities, you end up with three Dorian tribes. The Dorians always have three tribal divisions, always, and they're always the same.
So that predated the migration, in other words.
Well, I have a theory about that. Yes, okay. It must have predated the population.
Must have.
Yeah. And some cities like Argos in Peloponnese, you end up with, Sicyon, you end up with the three Dorian tribes and one other tribe, a non-Dorian tribe, that's able to hold on to its free independence, okay? But this, since the subject of tribes has come up, yes, the tribal divisions are extremely interesting in Greek culture, and they seem to emerge in this period, but we know almost nothing about them. Ionian Greeks, that is the Greeks who speak the dialect we call Ionic, but they thought of themselves as an ethnic group, okay? Ionian Greeks always are divided into four tribes, always, wherever we find them. But the four tribes don't always have the same names. Okay? Dorian Greeks are always divided into three tribes wherever we find them, and the tribes always have the same names. Okay? Whether you find Dorians in Crete or on the island of Rhodes or in Sparta or in Argos, they are divided into three tribes, and those tribes always have the same name. Now, this suggests to me two things. One, those tribal names predate these movements, all right, and were right. carried with them, as you just suggested, being the brilliant historian you are.
That seems logical, that it predates, right?
Why do the Ionians not always have the same names and the Dorians do? Well, my thesis, my hypothesis for that would be because the Dorians came from more or less a coherent area where those tribal names were given, and then they moved off. Whereas the Ionians did not. They communicated with each other. They knew about each other, but it wasn't a spreading out from one area. It was already a disparate group that moved. Okay, that's just a feeling.
But can I just to question that a little bit? Then why would they always have four if it hadn't pre-existed?
Well, the four may have pre-existed, right? So the
form existed, but not the names and characteristics
exactly.
of the four.
Right,
yeah,
right.
That makes great sense
to
me.
Yeah. Yeah. So then you get back to, you know, now we're pushing this back to this kind of pre-Dark Age, proto-Indo-European period, and asking ourselves, what do tribes do in an Indo-European culture? You know, what is the purpose of tribes? In later Greece, the tribes are their religious affiliations. They're theoretically ethnic affiliations, but no one could tell how he was related to someone else in a tribe. You know, you just knew you were from the tribe, but you couldn't say that's because our great-great-grandfather was X, okay? But you did have certain religious, rituals that you shared. There were tribal assemblies. But the main purpose of tribes, other than organizing religion, was organizing the military. And my theory about the origin of tribes is that they are tied primarily to, of course, to the religion, but to military organization, and that they essentially are the organization of a people on the move. Why don't the
marching columns, in other words?
Something about how are we going to organize ourselves as we, you know, make this trek? And what happens when we run up on bad guys? You know, we need some kind of way to organize ourselves.
Can I just stop right there?
Yeah.
That would also make sense if we then relate it to the Jewish flight from Egypt and the way that they organize that. It has a similarity to that.
That's
in a rough sense, you know?
Yeah. Interesting point. Yeah. And I would tie this to the origins of the polis. You know, the city-state arrangement that Greece has, by the time we get to 800, 850 BC, the Greeks are always organized in city-states, polis. And yet, the Mycenaean world is not organized by city-states. It's organized by these palaces and kingdoms. And in northern Greece, from which many of these Greeks eventually moved south, they never adopted the polis system. Northern Greece always has kingdoms, right? The Macedonians have kings. They don't live in city-states. So this suggests that kingdom organization, that's the place from which these other Greeks come.
That's the older model.
That's the older model, and it's the
Epirus
Homeric
like,
model.
Right. Epirus is like that as well, right? In the
Epirus
classical
was
period.
Like that as well, exactly.
Right.
So the North retained this older. So why is the South adopting the city-state organization and the North doesn't? Because the city-state organization is not actually an organization for a settlement. It is an organization for movement.
Movement and battle.
Yeah, exactly. I think the polis's origins are in the movement and not in the actual settlement. How do we organize ourselves when we move? And interestingly, the word polis in Athens, the word polis meant simply the mountain, the citadel, you know, on which, you know, the defensive fortification. The older Athenians didn't call the Acropolis what we call the high polis. They just called it the polis. Now, that's very suggestive to me. It suggests to me that the word polis tells you where something is, not what it is.
And the problem with the full interpretation of this is that the form emerges in this dark period and the written record of it is too weak to trace the structure.
Right. We have no written record of it. All we know is that when the Greeks step onto the scene again with their alphabet, they're all living in these city-states that they call poleis. Okay. And they're spreading them all over the Aegean, over the Mediterranean. We'll talk about in the next episode.
Sicily, Italy. Right. Turkey, what's now Turkey. Right.
So why would this, they come up with this new city-state organization in 800 or 750, and everybody accept it at the same time, and everybody starts spreading it all over the Mediterranean? That's completely implausible to me. But if they had been organizing themselves this way for hundreds of years, when they moved, then moving to a new colony in Italy or Sicily or in the Black Sea, how would you organize yourself? You'd adopt the organization you used before for movement.
Can I ask you one thing about this in the Dorian structure? Again, my knowledge is largely limited to Sparta, although Thebes is also a Dorian-speaking state, correct?
Thebes is not Dorian. They're not Ionian, but...
Right. It's not Ionian. It has a different sub-dialect.
It's an Aeolian substrate with another Northwest Greek dialect attached to it.
But Sparta has, if I remember correctly, dual kings, right?
Yes.
And that's would be unusual in the model you're suggesting, since it's further away from that northern, although that's where they originate, it's further away from that northern model, so to speak.
Yep. Well, the Spartans evince an extreme conservatism in their later political affinities, which you might hypothesize encouraged them to keep their kings longer than other Greek states. But even so, you know, the Athenians had kings too. They just reduced them to being purely religious officials, whereas in Sparta, and they were elected, whereas in Sparta, the kings retained their inherited positions. There's two of them, and they're religious officials and military commanders.
Right.
The thing about kings is not so different as it's often portrayed to be. Yeah.
Interesting. It's just, in other words, the way the word is used.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But this is fascinating to think about this system of Greek organization developing over these hundreds of years where we don't know anything. We can't see it happening. And what we know physically about this world is almost no stone architecture. Okay, so whereas before 1200, they're building these massive palaces and huge, you know, funeral monuments and, you know, grave circles, et cetera, et cetera. They're still burying people in sometimes in relatively opulent graves, but and I say relatively opulent, and there's only a few of those. But basically, the whole culture in terms of its wealth has collapsed, okay? No stone architecture. They don't have the organization to build those kind of buildings. They're not in contact with the rest of the cosmopolitan world. So that very little, if any, trade between mainland Greece and, you know, Egypt or mainland Greece and the Levant, right? So the artistic production of this period goes from the Mycenaean world. If you got a pot in Mycenae in 1250 BC or 1300 BC, it was going to have very naturalistic representations of octopi and cats and birds and human beings, you know, I told you about the gems they made, the beautiful little gold gems, cups. I mean, that all goes away. And in the Dark Age, you know, you got to picture a guy with a pot and a paintbrush, and he's drawing parallel lines. You know, the early proto-geometric
Something
pottery.
Was lost. Something was lost, yeah.
It all looks like second graders are making the pottery. You know, if it's 1050, it's proto-geometric pottery. They're parallel lines, circles, you know.
It perhaps went backwards is what you're suggesting.
Yeah. The idea that culture only progresses is completely ludicrous. But then around 950 or 900, they move on to geometric a pottery, which has, you use triangles and squares and rectangles to make, you know, dogs and human beings. And so everybody looks like, again, the stick figures that you drew when you were 6 years old. So you move from 2 year old to 6 year old.
In other words, it only took them 200 years to get back to a primitive form of what they had before.
Exactly, right.
We're coming up on our second break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Hi, this is Debbie Dedarian Demetriadis from Edgewood Travel. Things are opening up and it's time to go away. Small businesses fuel the economy, and our travel agency in Walpole is ready. Call us now more than ever and forget the internet. Call us at 508-668-2636. Again, 508-668-2636. Edgewood Travel, we make travel easy, and we've got your back. Bon voyage!
There's an old New England saying for just about everything in life, but our favorite is this one. Use only the finest 100% Arabica beans. We're the New England Coffee Company, and we've been perfecting the art of coffee roasting for over 85 years. All that experience has created a reputation for exceptional coffee, so that every cup is rich, satisfying, delicious, in the New England tradition. New England Coffee. Available at your local supermarket.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. We're talking about the dark age in Greece. But before we get back to this very dark story, Professor McConville, we have to welcome back one of our historical sponsors. Now, Brendan, I know you're a fan of A Quiet and Peaceful Neighborhood and that you're interested in the history of early European exploration and invasion of the Americas. Have you ever considered combining those two passions?
All the time.
Okay. Well, that's great. Well, you're going to be able to now with our historical sponsor, Conquistador Estates, a gated community. Conquistador Estates provides both peace and security for those wishing to experience life on the frontier. Since 1534, think about that, Professor McConville. Since 1534, yeah. Conquistador Estates has been making often successful and largely legal claims on lands in the New World. For only the small investment of 500 gold pistoles, that's 1,000 escudos, you can be reasonably assured of a home located in one of Conquistador Estates' several hundred relatively safe enclaves across the northern and southern hemispheres. And while Conquistador Estates cannot guarantee a clear title to your property, they do promise the kind of adventure many explorers would and have died for. You are also certain to encounter new cultures, new religions, and delicacies like chocolate, tobacco, and sweet potatoes. And if you join this week and mention the historians, you'll be invited to a special screening of Aguirre Wrath of God, hosted by none other than the director Werner Herzog himself, who I happen to know lives in one of the gated communities of Conquistador Estates. Now applicants must be hale and hearty individuals of 17 to 44 years of age. That leaves us out. Practicing Roman Catholics. So you're in there. Yep. They must possess a bronze or iron cuirass or helmet. A cuirass is a breastplate. And they must be certified in the use of either pike, broadsword, or musket. Now, there's a disclosure here that I'm supposed
I'm
to read.
I'm three for three.
There's a disclosure here I'm supposed to read, and it says something about the UN Charter and Amnesty International, but I'm just going to skip over that. All right. So please visit eldorado.com for more information and consider exploring the New World with Conquistador Estates, a gated community.
It sounds so appealing.
I hope that gate is pretty strong, you know, Conquistador Estates. There might be some angry Aztecs out there. I mean, they have a case, let's be honest.
They have plentiful reasons to be unhappy.
They really do. So, anyway.
Incidentally, someday we'll have to do a real series on 16th century Iberia and then the nature of conquest and the resistance to conquest and the Native Americans. Yeah. And I'd love to do that.
Yeah, we'll do it. We'll definitely do it. Conquistador Estates. Okay. Now, we talked about architecture. We talked about pottery. You know, pottery is not an exciting subject to talk about. You'd have to agree with that, wouldn't you, Professor McConville?
I don't know. I've met interesting pots and pans in the past, you know?
I think that's the one way I think that modern historians have it a little of an advantage is you guys don't have to talk as much about pottery as ancient historians do. Because it's basically the only thing that survives from many periods, you know? So that's what people talk about. Do you remember our colleague at Brown, James Kennelly?
Oh, I remember him. Yeah. How could I forget?
I was a very brilliant classical scholar who used to say that whenever somebody talked about the material culture, his response would be, they lived, they died, they used the implements that were common to their times.
Well, that's a hard analysis to debunk.
So, but there was another, at the end of this period of this dark age, there's another technological advancement that occurs, which I think we need to talk about and emphasize, and that's the re-emergence of literacy in the Greek world. You recall that the Greeks of the Mycenaean period wrote with this Linear B script. Linear B was a syllabic script. It basically looks like almost like hieroglyphs or ideograms. Little pictures of chariots, little pictures of tripods. And then there are symbols for syllables that are always join a consonant with a vowel. So you'll have a symbol for a ka sound and an ah sound, ka, or ku, or ko, or ki, right? Each image represents a syllable rather than a vowel or a consonant. And this is crucial for understanding what comes afterwards. So you asked me before we came on today whether any literacy survived the breakdown of these palaces. And the answer is yes. On the island of Cyprus, you will recall that some Greeks fled all the way across the eastern Mediterranean to the island of Cyprus. And on the island of Cyprus, they were writing with a script that was apparently developed from Linear A on Crete. This is what the linguists believe. When Greeks fled from the mainland to Cyprus, as we know they did, they fled from the island of Salamis, for example, and apparently founded a new place on Cyprus called Salamis, right? Like New Jersey and New York and New Haven, et cetera. They brought Linear B with them, and apparently the Linear B they brought influenced the script on Cyprus. So that Cypriot script becomes a kind of mishmash of elements of Linear A and elements of Linear B, all right? But the problem is that the Cypriot world is completely cut off from the rest of the Greek world.
And okay? The Cypriots continued to use, in other words, to write.
Yes.
And did they also, I bet you, they also traded with the Near East and with Egypt,
aha,
correct?
Yes, you are onto something, Professor McConville. Because look at where Cyprus is on a map. It's right smack dab up to the Levant. You know, it's within spitting distance, you know, or waving distance. Phoenicia is right there. Yeah. Well, the Phoenicians, of course, were a Semitic people who used a system of writing that was based on consonants. Right. And the hypothesis of one scholar is that the Cypriots came into contact with some Phoenicians. They were trading with them, et cetera, okay? And the Phoenicians were using their script to you know, what do you got there? I got 500 blankets, you know? How do you say that? Well, here's 500 blankets right here. It's written on the top of the pot because they put everything in pots.
In pots, right.
They even put pots in pots. You know, when you're shipping pots, you put them in pots. But that some clever Greek speaker looked at that Phoenician writing system and said, I can use that to write our language. I can use it to write Greek. But the key in the amazing innovation was that the Phoenician alphabet, it wasn't an alphabet, the Phoenician script only signified consonants. It's like Egyptian in that way. Egyptian writing only signifies consonants, and you have to infer the vowels. You look at the word and you either know what that word is, so you know which vowels you put it in to put in, or you guess. Okay. So in a sense, Semitic writing and Egyptian writing, Hebrew is true about Hebrew as well, is if you don't know the word, you can't actually sound it out. There's no such thing as sounding it out because the vowels aren't there. You just have a series of consonants. In other words, you can't read something that you don't already know. But the innovation of Greek was the man who said, or the woman who said, I'm going to take this system of writing consonants. I don't need all of these consonants that are in the system. I'm going to use some of these symbols to represent vowel sounds. Some of these symbols will represent O or I or E or ah. And I'll use those when I write so that I can hand you a word you've never seen before and you'll be able to say it. Because you have symbols for the vowels as well as for the consonants. So there are people out there that think this is the single most important technological invention in human history.
Because it's a close runner-up with fire, right? I mean,
it allows the transmission of information to people who don't already know it. It allows you to read things you've never seen or heard before. It's a remarkable idea that somebody had.
We don't know, have any idea.
No, but the theory that it happened on Cyprus, for the reasons that you inferred, is quite good. It makes a lot of sense.
Where did the Phoenician script come from? Do we know?
Well, the Semitic, the Phoenicians are relatives of the ancient Hebrews. The language is quite similar. I couldn't tell you what the origin of that script is, what relationship it has to Egyptian hieroglyphs or Akkadian or Sumerian. Or, I mean, the Akkadian is written with the little wedge shapes, cuneiform. So it's probably more closely related to something like Egyptian than it is to Akkadian. Sumerian, I'm not so familiar with. But out of this literate world of the Hebrew/Phoenician world of writing, the Greeks, some Greeks, adopted this. And so the alphabet, what we call the alphabet, it's a great name for it because alpha, of course, is a vowel and beta is a consonant. And this is the first system of writing that has both of those things, vowels and consonants. And of course, everybody's going to get them after this. Everybody's going to want
that. Well, the thing is that in all seriousness, because of the reasons you just said, you can see the advantage of that system and why it would spread.
Huge, huge advantage. When the Greeks emerged from this dark age around 800 BC, and they emerge with a system of writing that gives them an advantage that at that point no one else has. And they have a system of organization, the polis, where however it was created, which is going to prove to be one of the most, adaptable systems of human organization ever invented. And they show up and start writing, and we get this amazing literature that seems to just come out of nowhere, like Homer, okay? Hesiod, we'll talk about maybe in the next episode. But that's not what happened, right? It didn't emerge out of nowhere. For hundreds of years, Greeks have been singing songs about the Trojan War and the events around the Trojan War. So that around 800 or 750, when they get writing, when they get this new script, forget about Linear B, it's dead and gone. We got this new thing. It's way better than Linear B. What do? They start writing Homer. They start writing down the poetry that they've been singing, the songs that they've been listening to for ages.
How long does it take the polis, whoever is the rulers in the polis, to begin to use writing as a form of control and structure in the polis?
That's a tremendously good question. And we can't answer it, but I can give you some theories about it. One is that writing is often involved in the law-giving constitutional recreation process. So Dracon in Athens, very early, 621, we'll have a whole show on Dracon and Solon. Writing down the law is key to what Dracon is doing, right? Writing down the law, key to what Solon is doing. So there's a clear connection between written law and, political revolution or if you want to use the word progress or change, whatever value judgment you want to put on it. So writing and the organization of the state and control of the state are definitely involved. And they're involved as early as we can see these things, by the 7th century. So 100 years after the period we're talking about now. But it's possible, of course, that for 100 years, writing plays no role in law. Right, it's just something you use for trade or something you use for to remember that great piece of poetry that you really loved, you know, and you want to write it on a pot or whatever.
Or some discussion of the Trojan War or whatever.
Right. Keep in mind, too, that they didn't write only left to right the way we do. When they start out, they write left to right sometimes, and they write right to left sometimes. And sometimes they go backwards and forwards, left to right, right to left. This is called boustrophedon, which means as the cow turns. Okay.
As the cow turns.
Right. As the ox turns.
We are coming up on our final break. We'll be right back. We're the historians.
Welcome to our neighborhood. Our family has been doing business here since 1914. That's our tradition, and that's why we call ourselves Old Neighborhood Foods, bringing you the finest deli meats for over 100 years, all crafted from our family recipes with the finest ingredients, with no MSG, gluten, or trans fats. That's the old-fashioned way. Old Neighborhood, a family legacy of quality and taste.
Old Neighborhood quality meats and cold cuts, available in the deli cases of all Demoulas Market Baskets and wholesale for restaurants, pizza shops, and delis through Costa's Provisions. Old Neighborhood, Palia Gitonia, a family business owned and operated by the DeMarcus family since 1914.
Demoulas Supermarkets, under the trade name Market Basket, is a chain of 80 supermarkets in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Maine. Demoulas Supermarkets, Market Basket, more for your dollar.
All right, we're back. We're the historians. For information on the historians or any program on WNTN Global Echoes Radio, visit our website, WNTN1550AM.com, and you can reach us at therealhistorians@gmail.com, and you can go on the website and listen to old episodes if you want. You know, maybe you want to do that Irish arc. All 7 episodes, one after the other. You can binge listen. How about that? So go back, listen to some old episodes of The Historians and hear younger versions of Professor McConville and myself.
We're not getting any younger.
And we're not getting any better. Oh, well, the Dark Age, where we're fully out of it now. We have our writing system and Greece is up and running again.
In the future, we're going to come back. We want to talk about how that literate culture begins to develop, how that sort of explosion of literacy begins to define the Greek world and it begins to define the nature and our historical understanding of the polis.
Yep,
but right now, we're going to turn to our continuing feature, This Week in Historical News.
This Week in Historical News, my favorite segment.
Once again, we only have one obituary, a fellow named Chad Calpea Babion. Who is that? He is one of the people who played a role in preserving and sort of extending the Polynesian ability, you know, seafaring abilities that had begun to be lost in the 20th century. Part of the group of Polynesian peoples who kept those things alive, star navigation, understanding of ocean currents, what the shape of waves, what it tells us about the sea in front of you, the nature of bird migration and how it's connected to where islands and reefs are. He's passed away at age 64. He wasn't part of one of the original generation who did that, but he was sort of the heir to that original generation and extended that. And of course, one of the things we've talked about often in private is just how spectacular these Polynesian people are as seafarers.
Unbelievable.
Given the size of the Pacific and the challenges, it's just surreal. And one of the interesting things that sort of drew me to his obituary, he was a relatively young man. He was 64. But they found some of these in a dig somewhere. They found some evidence of a canoe, and it answered one of the questions that they had, which is, in other words, look, these canoes go to sea, and of course, the Pacific, it makes the Atlantic look like a lake.
Right.
And how did they survive, given that they had to encounter severe storms?
Yeah.
So it turns out that at least some of the Polynesian cultures, had figured out how to counter-flood the outriggers. In other words, they hollowed out a portion, they would seal it, and then when they could tell that, hey, a storm is going to come, they would counter-flood it and subtly sink the thing so it wasn't vulnerable to being flipped over. And then they would tie themselves to the boat and the counterweight and ride it out at sea, like in a manner that distributed their weight around the thing so it wouldn't flip over.
Yeah, and then
when it was over, they would counter, you know, they would pump it dry, basically, you know, bail it out.
I was with you right up to the moment where you had to tie yourself to the ship.
It just shows you how spectacular they were, right? I mean, they're just spectacular. He has passed away. He was on one of the voyages where they sailed from, basically sailed from one of the other Polynesian islands to Hawaii. And of course, that's no easy task because Hawaii is relatively isolated from the rest of Polynesia, as is New Zealand and as is, say, Easter Island. Just amazing.
Imagine putting a bunch of modern Americans, just take a group of 20-year-olds, put them on an island in the middle of the Pacific and tell them, you're going to have to go find food.
Imagine putting a group of middle-aged Americans.
No. I'm just trying to choose the best possible, youngest, most hale and hearty you could, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not doing it.
I had wanted to mention is that there has been a severe fire in Cape Town that burned, among other things, a library housing African antiquities at the University of Cape Town, which was severely damaged, which had antiquities both from the African cultures and from the Boer culture of the Dutch speaking people who had settled there in the late 16th, early 17th centuries. There were Dutch outposts there. There's been a severe fire there. And of course, that kind of archive or museum fire, it can be devastating in terms of our knowledge of a period. It really can be. And I also wanted to talk, which I've been meaning to come to, but we just, because of the way the news went, we have not had time. I did want to discuss, again, the Benin bronzes, which has been an issue, and we've talked about it previously, which are artworks from what would be Western Nigeria and the country of Benin. Mm-hmm. And these artworks were looted in the 19th century. They ended up in Europe. Some of them ended up in the British Museum, as many things tend to do. I mean, that was the nature of the 19th century, but it's not the nature of the 21st century. They've discovered several of these in L.A., in several of the museums in L.A. I mean, they are just spectacular artwork. This is from a piece from the Associated Press, I think, from the beginning of May. But they really... They're in all of these museums. There is stuff that was looted out of Benin and Western Nigeria in the late 19th century, and it scattered the material. It's harder to see which groups produced it. It's really created a crisis, and there's been a drive to restore them to the cultures that produced them in Africa, which I happen to agree with. I think that that's a good idea in this moment. I mean, of course, there's tremendous legal and cultural issues involved in terms of people not wanting, but it seems entirely appropriate to me that these should be restored. They're not all made of bronze, incidentally. Some are wood carvings, some are ivory carvings, some are bronzes, but it's a pretty, collectively, because they've been spread all over the place, their collective power as a body of work has been lost to a certain degree. And of course, it would be great if they could be brought together in Benin or Western Nigeria in a museum or in an appropriate way. Some of them may have religious significance to the groups that are there now. I don't know that. I don't know enough about them. But I do think that just as with the Elgin marbles, it's, you know, the 19th century was the 19th century, but we're in the 21st century. It's time for these things to be restored to the cultures that produced them.
Yeah.
And I find it very unfortunate that sort of there's some movement that way, particularly with the Benin bronzes. But you have to be concerned in a sense there's not more movement that way.
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, the Acropolis Museum in Athens, the new Acropolis Museum, they have left places for the Elgin marbles to be returned, right? The empty spots are there to put them in.
It's just another, I mean, I'm sure because I know that you know, of course, you're a great admirer of Greek, both contemporary Greece and classical Greek culture and archaic Greek culture, that it's certainly time for them to be restored to where they came from. And of course, you know, so that people who visit Greece can fully enjoy and fully, you know, come to a deeper understanding of the culture there. Similarly, with these Benin bronzes, that the people who produce them and the cultures that produce them, that people who visit there or people who live there now can enjoy what was produced and learn from it and to, you know, come to a deeper understanding of it.
It's just the right thing to do.
It's just the right thing to do. Yeah. There is was an article in the Wall Street Journal on May 14th entitled "A Maritime Solution for Cyber Piracy" by a guy named Thomas Ayers, who's a retired U.S. Army general. He served as general counsel to the U.S. Air and Space Force 2018 to 2021. He basically believes the title of the piece is A Maritime Solution for Cyber Piracy. As I said, he wants to reintroduce the idea of privateers, which was used in the 17th and 18th century to raid enemy shipping. And what these were they were private ships fitted out by private individuals, but given a letter of marque or a letter of privateering by the government that they lived in, and then said, basically, okay, if we're say Great Britain or we're England and we're at war with France, you can raid French shipping, or you know, we're at war.
You hire your own pirates.
Right, you hire your own pirates. Now he's saying we should allow hackers who go after these bad hackers who like attack that pipeline, any hacker who sort of destroys them or puts these other hackers in their place or, you know, sort of identifies them and tells us where to find them, they should get a percentage on, you know, some kind of percentage. In other words, we would be the equivalent of computer privateers searching for enemy vessels or enemy strong points and raiding them, essentially.
Right. Well, my reaction to that story would be, number one, if we're not already doing that, then I'm very disappointed in our government. Number two, the stupidest thing you could possibly do is to do that and announce it.
Agreed.
Then you give the, you know, reason to the premise, you know, you establish the, yeah, you do that, but you don't tell anybody you're doing it.
I mean, right. I completely agree. This is from a vote in Chile. Chile is coming up on an election, and at that time, at this time, the election, I believe, is still being contested, but they're going to rewrite the part of the what was has been going on is that they voted to rewrite the Constitution of Chile. And there hasn't been a left-leaning government really in Chile since Allende was overthrown by Pinochet, I believe, in 1973, that we would see as hard left. And some of the people invited into this constitution writing are apparently hard leftists. And of course, there's been a lot of writing in Chile.
Well, they elected them, right?
I mean, right. Some of them are into elected positions. And so there's a, because now you're dealing with generations who don't remember what happened in the 1970s. Pinochet, of course, was a general in the army. The army overthrew the elected civilian government, which was a leftist government. The U.S. government was involved in that. What's going on now is that the leftists have been elected to this constitutional writing committee, constitutional convention committee. And it marks a really fundamental shift because Chile had been held up as a market, you know, free market model for Spanish speaking people in the Western Hemisphere. It's clear there's now a shift to the left, just as there is in Peru, which suffered under a very sort of serious insurgency in the 1980s and 90s into this century known as the Shining Path, really before this century. But and now there's a left-leaning government, or going to be, or they're coming into an election with a left-leaning government having a very strong chance of getting into office. There's talk of nationalization of industry. Chile and Peru, which is something we've been talking about in private, are two of the leading copper producers in the world. And the copper supply, which is essential, just like silicon, to the continuation of our technological advancement in terms of all the computers, all the electric cars, all the technology we see, there really is a fundamental issue there about how the global copper supply, which has functioned in a certain way for a long time, is going to continue to function if they're nationalized. I mean, it really does erase that. But I did think we don't cover Spanish speaking, you know, the part of the Western Hemisphere much at all, really, because of modesty. We don't know enough about, I don't anyway. I mean,
well, I'm all for more coverage of Chile and Argentina, because not only is Chile a major copper producer, but they produce beef, good wine, and great trout fishing.
Yeah, so. Argentina, you're right. And also, I mean, we're both interested in the Inca, the Mayans, the Aztec cultures, and the other cultures of Central America. We're quite interested in that, but, you know, we don't have a huge amount of knowledge of it. I did want to get to some more. There's been some more stuff about the 1619 project and the idea of, there's a piece in the May 17th Wall Street Journal entitled, Can Freedom Survive the Narratives? And what this guy's name is Lance Morrow. He's a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. But basically what he's saying is different historical narratives are being introduced in a manner that is creating an underlying social chaos in the U.S. And that some of these narratives are essentially, as you've said, anti-narratives. They don't exist as, you know, in other words, there's no measure against the past or understanding that the past was different than now.
Right.
And I think at some point in the future, I would really like us to sort of take these the bull by the horn, so to speak, on these issues of, about that. It's related issues of iconoclastic violence against statues, about this, what we call freedom of speech and freedom of the press and how they're functioning. Those things are so volatile that it's possible we'll lose our jobs if we go there. But
very possible.
Very possible. But I think that we do need to talk about that.
Absolutely.
So we are coming up on our on the end of the show. I did want to mention this, though, which I've also been meaning to get in, from the April 24th Boston Globe. Mattel hits four-year high on sales of Barbie.
Wow, Barbie's sales are up.
Yeah, I think I've mentioned this on the other show as well.
There's been a lot of Barbie information, yes.
There's a lot of Barbie information flowing right now, and they're not only that, but they're coming out with more historical Barbies, which we had discussed in a previous episodes. Historical Barbies are back.
Do we know any of them? The Frida Kahlo Barbie, I remember. The Amelia Earhart Barbie.
For some reason, I'm thinking there's going to be a Ruth Bader Ginsburg Barbie. But that may be wrong. I may be seriously, but I may be misremembering that. But there will be additional Barbies, and the Barbie sales, as I mentioned on the other show, are surging, but there are new historical Barbies coming. The historians will cover this. We have come up on the end of the show. We'll be back soon with a continuation of our thread on archaic Greece. We're the historians.